everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. This week, I'm interviewing Momoko Uno, who, in this interview, does confess that she has been studying or learning in love with education since the age of 3. Among many other things, she is a doctor of integrative medicine, a certified functional medicine practitioner, an acupuncturist, and a board-certified Chinese herbalist. She received her first medical degree from Shanghai University of Chinese Medicine, and then also received a master's of acupuncture from Samra University, as well as a master's in psychology from the University of Santa Monica. We have such a fun conversation this week, and to be honest, I was kind of fangirling all over her. I was finally able to answer a lot of questions that I have around health and acupuncture and the body and just how mysterious Oriental medicine is. I thought that we had a rip-roaring good time talking to each other, and I suspect you'll be able to tell that just by listening to this podcast. Momoko's miracle has to do with her mother and something that happened during COVID. And while I was listening to her story, I kind of understood that what did happen was, in fact, very miraculous, considering the state of the world at that time. But I'll let Momoko tell it in her own words a little bit later on in this episode. Thanks to all of you who listen, but especially thanks to Momoko for agreeing to be on the podcast. So now, without further ado, here's the very next episode of Bite-Sized Blessings.
Okay, so this doesn't happen all the time, but it's magical when it happens. And so if somebody comes to see me, and I'll often say, oh, it's going to take some time, you know. I'll take some sessions. I don't know how long, but I'll take some sessions. And they come back the next time. They're like, it's gone. I'm like, oh, well, I didn't realize that. I'm not that good. I don't know what happened. But that occasionally that happens. And that's incredible when that happens for them. And well, then for me too, I guess. But, placebo. There's a lot of things that play into that, right? It's amazing. I think the first thing that I would say is I'm a mother. I have 6 cats, 2 dogs, 2 guinea pigs and a hamster. That's the first thing that I would say. And then if they wanted to know more, I would then go into my work. I would say that I'm a doctor of integrative medicine. I'm also a board certified Chinese herbalist and a licensed acupuncturist. Certified functional medicine practitioner, and I have a master's in psychology with an emphasis in consciousness, health, and healing.
And where are you located? I'm so curious.
My office is in New York City, but I live in Westchester, New York, and I'm from Australia.
Okay. Yeah, because I absolutely need to see someone who does everything that you do, but I'm based in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And so
It's a little far.
It's a little far. Yes. But holy cannoli, talk about, first of all, for those of my listeners who don't know, just getting a functional medicine degree is totally crazy pants. But then on top of that, you have integrative medicine, you have Oriental medicine. Oh my goodness. So, I mean, how long were you in school for?
My entire life. Yeah. And I started when I was 3 years old and it continued. It's still continuing now.
So it sounds like you're like me and you love to learn.
I do. I really do. I love to learn. And I'm really fascinated by the human body, the mind, the emotions, our spirit. And I want to know more about how it works. what makes us tick, what makes us happy, why we're here.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I actually just finished reading this book by David Eisenberg. Do you know the one that I'm talking about?
Oh, I don't.
I have it right here. Hold on.
Okay.
It's an old book. Came out in 95, I think, or 85. I don't know. It's called Encounters with Chi.
Ah.
And he was, have you heard of it?
I'm so sorry. I feel like I should have.
No. He was like a Harvard in medical school. And for the first time, they were allowing China and the U.S. to send physicians from China to the U.S., from the U.S. to China to study. And so he was able to go over, I think, for 3 months, 6 months, and study with Chinese acupuncturists, Oriental medicine doctors.
In the 90s, you said, or earlier,
yes,
sorry.
I think it was 85.
Yeah, I forgot the first people that went into China, I think, might have been in the 80s.
Okay.
Where there was somebody who witnessed open heart surgery.
Yes.
While, was that in the book?
Yes. Without anesthetic.
Yes. Okay. So I know the book because I've read that part. Sorry, I forgot who it was written by.
No, but it is utterly astonishing. I mean, I started the book and finished it in one day because I could not put it down. And I didn't even know there was such a thing first of all, I'm completely just besotted, if you can use that word, with chi and the idea that it exists in the world, but it totally makes sense. And that, you know, that we probably should be paying more attention to it, or not even that, just maybe having a relationship with it in our own bodies so that we can have a conversation with it. Because the chi, I mean, I don't know. Can you describe for my audience what chi is?
Well, you know, that's the $1 million question. You know,
yes.
I've been doing this for almost 30 years, and I don't really have a great explanation for it. The more I study, I feel like the less that I know. But anyway, it is loosely translated as energy, right? But it's not just physical energy. It also morphs into emotional energy, mental energy, your spirit. And it's just the finer parts of all of those energies. It's kind of like if you think of ice, water, and steam, it's the steam.
Yeah, and it is one of those things. First of all, I read reviews of this book on Amazon, and it's an older book. People were like, some of this stuff is so outdated. And I was like, of course it is. I mean, the book is outdated, but it is actually really interesting. And she is it's almost like there are no words for it. It's like if you try to pin it down and define it, you're grasping at the air or at smoke trying to define it. But, you know, my little Star Wars loving heart is like, oh, it's the Force and it's in everything. It's, you know,
it is. Yes, yeah. Everything's chi, right? You could even, the air is chi. Yeah, and interestingly enough, we're mostly just air. As well, you know, we, of course, we're physical matter, but between the physical matter, we're mostly just quite airy too.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and that's the energy that can transmit between one person and another.
Yeah.
If you want to get a little bit more esoteric, but you can, you know, even if you don't know much about it, if you're around somebody that has not great energy, you can kind of feel it, right? You know what I mean? You can totally feel that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, first of all, I'm a huge, huge proponent. I've had acupuncture forever. I remember going to a physician when I was in college just for something else. I need to get some blood work done. And he said, hey, you know, I'm kind of this is a long time ago because I'm really old. So
please
be aware of this. So he said, I've been kind of dabbling in acupuncture and I want to stimulate one of your four gates. And I thought, I don't even know what this man is saying to me, but okay. And he put a needle in right here on my hand, mm-hmm. right there. And I felt the energy move between wherever my fingers. And I thought, okay, what just happened? And that's was my first inkling that there was something pretty profound going on. I think a lot of people in this book, Encounters with Chi, you know, some of the masters, the most important thing I thought that they really tried to convey was, you know, when we are kind of trying to figure out what we need to work on a human being or someone who comes to see us for help. It's too late. We should be working on them before the symptoms arise. Yes. And so I think that's actually, it's almost like we should all be getting acupuncture anyway, even before we get sick.
Correct. That is true. That is traditionally how Chinese medicine was actually practiced. You had a provider, a doctor that you went to saw, and they only got paid if you were healthy. And then if you were sick, your doctor was not paid until you were better. And if somebody died in your care, they put these lanterns outside your shop, basically, to show that somebody had died under your care.
Well, wow, that's not good advertising.
No, it isn't. And I think that's kind of unfair because, you know, if you have like a 99-year-old patient or somebody and who dies, I don't know how they really would have handled that. But that was, I don't know if that's the myth that I was told or if that was reality, but I could see that Chinese medicine was basically it's a preventative medicine. It's not, unfortunately, Chinese medicine is not really practiced that way in America. It's like any medicine, you go see your acupuncturist or your doctor when you're not feeling well.
Yeah, absolutely. The train has left the station. Well, one of the things that was just remarkable, and you and I talked about it a little earlier, not only the open heart surgery without anesthetic, but he got to witness a brain surgery without anesthetic. And, you know, I mean, even in the book, okay, it's 85. I don't know if they know now, but he said in the book, we have no idea why the placement of certain needles in certain points of the body keep people from feeling pain during these pretty massive surgeries. Have we figured that out yet?
Well, some of it's nervous system stuff, right? Like it's just a nerve block that you have, and then others is completely meridian. The energy of the pathways, the energetic pathways that the chi takes. And if you block an energetic pathway, then you're not going to feel it in a distal portion, like further away from the body. So that's the theory behind that. But you can explain anything that way, really. Is it? I like to still hold on to it that it's somewhat mysterious. But I do want to say, though, in terms of, so I actually met somebody who witnessed open heart surgery. One of my mentors actually, I think, was the acupuncturist who was doing the surgery on somebody having an open heart surgery. And he said that it's not like the patient doesn't feel anything. They actually do have sensation, and you have to pick the right patients too that are able to stay calm. So there is, you can kind of feel it, but it's not painful. That's the best way that they described it. I wasn't there. I haven't seen it in person, but I know people who have.
Thank you for that. And I do also think it's really important what you brought up earlier, that acupuncture, oriental medicine, also tends to the emotional being of the person, the mental being of the person, the intellect, because, you know, because I've been doing it for so long, I love to learn. And so I'm always, my long-term relationships with acupuncturists, I'm always asking them questions.
It's great.
And I'm like, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? So, you know, my last one in Santa Fe said, oh, I'm going to release some grief. I see some in the palm of your hand here where the thumb kind of meets the hand. And she said, can I bleed you? And I said, I don't know what that means. And she said, well, I'm going to poke you with a needle in about three places. And it's just going to sting. You have to know I'm a beekeeper as well. So I've been stung by bees. So acupuncture is kind of negligible. And she said, also to let you know, at some point, maybe in the next 24 to 48 hours, you might start crying unexpectedly and not even know what's happening, but it's okay. It's what was being released from these points. And I was like, okay, whatever. I don't believe you. And then later that night, after she bled me, I just started sobbing and sobbing for no reason. And so, you know, every once in a while I go see her. I just find the whole process so fascinating and evocative. And so I'll say, oh, you know, you can bleed me if you want today. If you feel like it needs to happen, I'm down, because I just find that connection so, it's just so fascinating to me. So what's going on there?
So she needled an area which is part of your lung channel. And in Chinese medicine, we say that grief is housed in the lungs. So if you have any emotion that's repressed, it tends to go outside the torso and then into the limbs and get stored there, just so that we can function, you know, so that our brain can stay as clear as possible. It siphons off any traumatic energy or anything that's unwanted so that we can focus and get on with our day. And it goes into the hands, into the feet, but basically into the extremities, into the arms and legs. And, you know, that's great and all, because we do need to function. And, but the problem is, if we do that too much, it gets stored in our limbs. Does that make sense? It backs up in the limbs. And so it's nice to have that taken out for us. It's like taking out the trash.
Yes.
And so you want to take that out occasionally. And, if you've gone through a really stressful period, you might need to take out the emotional trash a little bit more often than when you've gone through a kind of a reasonably, you know, stable period in your life. But it's good to get done. And you can usually tell, especially when we get a little bit older, when there is actually, you can see those little blood vessels that are forming, capillaries. Yeah. So you can see those around your thumbs, especially around your wrists, they tend to form, and then mostly on the legs. Like spider veins and stuff like that. Those are usually seen as what we call law vessels in Chinese medicine, where those extra emotions, they get stored because we haven't been able to release them.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. You were saying before we started the interview, I'm going to stay on topic and we're not going to go off on these tangents, but I'm forcing you to. And thank you so much for, totally for doing that with me. You know, I am such a huge proponent of Oriental medicine that any chance I get, because we have Western medicine, but I think Western medicine oftentimes does not engage with or even want to approach our emotional wellness, our mental health wellness. And all of these are different energies, right, that are swirling in the body and contributing to various things. And so I really do deeply feel that Oriental medicine is so essential, because it works on every kind of level that a human being needs to work on. It doesn't mean that it's all you do is you go in and you lay down. That's not what it means at all. I mean, yes, there is that. You go in and you lay down and, you know, they'll moxibustion you or whatever. They'll cup you, which is also a favorite thing of mine. I think it's fascinating. I also get, I had Tuina done, so massage and then cranial sacral. And it's just such powerful work and I always felt better, but it doesn't happen in one visit. It usually takes multiple visits because these are things that need to be worked on, and maybe those things need to be cajoled out of hiding, you know, hey, you need healing in this space and it's going to take some time. So every single person is different.
Yes, that's right. Every single practitioner will have a slightly different approach, which is good. And sometimes you'll find that certain providers you'll have a better connection with for whatever reason. And that's usually because you have like similar issues, or that person has already had a lot of experience treating your condition, which is nice when you find somebody like that. But there's also certain practitioners who have just more awareness, who have more experience of understanding how the mind and the emotions affect the body.
And just before we move on to the next question, I also think this idea of qi and that everything's made of qi kind of takes away and completely removes the idea that we're separate from our environment, that we're kind of just all walking around in this world and everything is communicating with us and our qi is in relationship with everything around us. Did I say that okay?
Yes. No, you're absolutely right. And it is really like the extension of the air around us, right? I think that we are really connected, and it's more like, you know, like the roots of the trees that connect with, you know, together. So we're much more connected on that level. And we feel most of that through, you know, our environment. We actually feel through multiple different levels of our nervous system. And I think that our environment has a tremendous impact on how we feel, how we think. I think it often gets disregarded, and we often think that we're these little islands that float around and don't really interact with each other, but I don't think that's true. I think we influence each other quite a lot.
I am ever so curious. When you were a kid, did you think you'd be doing what you're doing now?
No. I thought when I was 10 years old that I was going to be a hairdresser. So my favorite thing to do when I was 3 or 4 years old was to cut my sister's hair. Bald. My favorite thing.
How old was your sister? Oh, no.
Two. And I think I was like 4 years old. And I would run into the kitchen and I would steal the scissors and I'd cut off my sister's hair.
Did you ever get in trouble for that?
All the time.
Oh, my gosh. I've never heard anything. So does she ever bring that up and say?
Fortunately, she was too young. She doesn't remember.
Oh, gosh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I'm curious, did you grow up in a religious household? And if so, or if not, how has that evolved over time for you?
So I actually went to, well, my family originally was from Japan, and they were Shinto. It's like the national religion of Japan. It's kind of like, it's more to do with naturalism. But my parents weren't religious. My dad actually was an atheist. But then when I was four years old, I went to a Christian school that I went through until high school. So I had a lot of Christian education, Anglican in particular. And then my mother found Zen Buddhism when I was probably around 12, somewhere around then. So she had a very interesting path to find Buddhism. There was also a period of studying crystals and yoga and all that kind of stuff before she landed in Buddhism. And then when I went to college, then I was very interested in religion in general and just by myself, and also Chinese medicine. Chinese medicine is very much influenced by Buddhism and Taoism, Confucianism, and so that was all a part of my larger education.
Yes, I think if I'm correct, and correct me if I'm wrong, Shintoism is very animistic. Is that true?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, and very much. I mean, there's a really deep belief in spirits, that everything has is alive and has spirits.
Absolutely. I don't know a whole lot about Shinto, because even though my family was their family religion, they didn't really talk about it that much. It was really only when I was in middle school that my mother started talking about a religion a lot. And that was very much more from a Buddhist perspective. But when I was older, I went to a lot of shrines in Japan and read a little bit about it. But a lot of it's so much to do with nature and just being more at peace with nature and the environment. It's amazing. It's still, I think, quite similar to Taoism in that respect.
Thank you for that. And I was going to ask, when did your family emigrate?
They moved from Japan to Australia, I think, in the early 70s. Yeah, just before I was born. I was born there. Yeah.
Oh, you were born in Australia?
Yes.
Okay, got it. Yeah. And then was there a reason they moved to Australia?
You know, this is one of those questions that I wanted to ask my parents before they passed away, but I never really got a great answer to that. So all I know is that my grandfather was a politician, and he passed away when I was, I think, in high school. And he wanted his children to move out of Japan and go to an English-speaking country, I think maybe to develop international relationships with different countries. And I'm not sure why they chose Australia, because my aunt moved to Canada. But yeah, so I don't know why they landed in Australia. I've always wanted to ask. we can make up great theories of why my parents moved to Australia.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, yes, absolutely. That's actually really fascinating. And then when did you move to the States? Because you're in the States, I think, permanently now.
Yes, I've been in the States for more than 25 years now. Okay. Yes, a long time. This is the longest I've lived anywhere.
And then I also was seeing because I want to just satisfy my curiosity, which is endless. It says that you studied botanical medicine. And what does that mean? Oh,
sorry, that's just Chinese herbal medicine.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, and also also in general, other botanicals as well. So that's anything that's plant medicine.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's anything to do with, you know, much like broader in terms of anything that's plant-based and has a medicinal effect on the body.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gosh. So I'm guessing that, well, I don't want to assume. So I'm ever so curious about, and if you get sick of hearing me say the word curious, do you just blow a whistle? It's okay. How do you as a, I don't know, let's start with Doctor of Oriental Medicine. How do you view the new kind of groundbreaking research and the world that's opening up around plant medicines as healers for PTSD? And I'm speaking specifically of, like, you know, ayahuasca. And entheogens, I guess.
That's not an area that I am well versed in at all, but I have colleagues that not only dabble with it, but are actually really in and practice that. And they also do therapy assisted with different substances. And I think it's great. But I do think that we are still relatively new with it. And I think that more people do it in very large volumes, we'll have a lot more information as we move forward. It's also not something that I have done really myself either. I haven't really dabbled in it much. And for example, you know, one thing that I've really, this is just to do with a CBD, for example, right? I know that's not necessarily what you're talking about, but that's something that I dabbled personally in with a lot. And then I realized after trying it that there were actually significant issues for me and then also with my patients. I actually used to recommend it quite a lot, and now I've been a lot more cautious with using cannabis related substances. So I think with more use, we'll have a lot more information because this is all pretty new. And also because there's so many different people that are trying it these days, I think that more the minor issues that haven't been really well researched will start coming forward. And then we'll learn how to navigate through that better. Sorry, that's not a very great answer, but.
No, I mean, just I'm interested in all sorts of alternative healings because I am someone, I've done a lot of them. I mean, certainly not all of them, but a lot of them. And I have come to understand that, you know, human beings are endlessly creating new ways of approaching the body, you know, and working with it and healing it from, you know, somatic trauma to mental health to, you know, physical issues. And I mean, and as you and I have been saying, like every single person will have a different need. They might go in with the same, like say two people came to you with water retention, you would of course feel their pulses and ask tons of questions and have conversations with them. And at the end of the session with them, you would probably recommend Chinese herbs, but even though they have the same thing, their herbs could be completely different because they are different people.
Absolutely. So Chinese medicine has differential diagnosis, so within any kind of syndrome or actual illness, Western medicine like diagnosis, it's going to be usually on average like five different categories that it could fall under. And if you don't treat it the right way, you're not going to get results, or you might only get temporary results. So that's very important from a Chinese medical perspective, to make sure that your diagnosis is correct.
Yeah. And I think also something that I learned within the last few years, I think looking at people's tongues is just the most fascinating thing ever, but also taking people's pulses is fascinating. And you can learn a lot from people's pulses. I was seeing a woman in Santa Fe and she was feeling my pulse on my left arm, I think. And she said, "May I ask you a personal question?" I said, "Sure. Yes, absolutely." And she said, "Are you doing what you're supposed to be doing in this life? Like, are you actually living the life that you're supposed to be?" And I started laughing and I said, "Of course not. Of course I'm not. I am just trying to make money to pay my rent and get by. Of course I'm not doing what I'm." And I said, "You could tell that from my pulse?" And she said, "Absolutely."
Yeah. So you have to be pretty skilled to be able to feel that. But I'll tell you probably what she was feeling on the left side, right? Left side, first position is where your heart is. So what she was feeling was the pulse. The heart pulse should kind of come out like this, and it should be like a little bit of a fountain. And that's like somebody whose heart is full and is, believe me, I don't feel this too often. In your case, it felt a little restricted. It wasn't like fountaining out. It was just going like a little like that.
And I think in the work that I've done over this last few years, I've really come to understand, and this is for my listeners too, that our hearts hold a lot of things that we don't want to talk about or that we don't want to acknowledge, and things that we'd rather ignore, a lot of truths that we'd rather ignore. And I think sometimes it's just difficult to even begin to approach any of that. But our heart, I think, will sooner or later let us know that it's tired of being ignored. And it's such a powerful organ. I mean, so are the kidneys, so is the liver. But the heart, I mean, it's called the emperor, I think.
That's right. It's considered top notch. It is more important than the brain in Chinese medicine, pretty much. Yeah. So, you know, the way that I like to think about it is, are we doing what we want rather than what we think we should be doing? It's the difference between should and want. And the heart for us really wants us to be doing what we want to be rather than what people have told us that we should be doing. And then the heart starts getting smaller and smaller. I'm not saying it atrophies. I am saying that the function of the heart starts to feel like it gets tired and lethargic and doesn't want to pump as much because it's not really enthusiastic or engaged with what you're doing.
And I've kind of lately, and I encourage everyone to do this. I was telling someone that I have begun to think of my heart as this little alien that's living inside my chest, and it has its own mind about what's going on. And so maybe we could be best friends, and I should really start having a conversation with it and inviting it for a cup of tea and saying, "Hey, what's going on in your world?" Because I do believe that, any part of the body, you know, if it needs attention, if it feels like it's being ignored or if it's being put upon, or it's just like stressed to its limit, it will let us know. And it behooves us to pay attention.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, the Western medical model does, it often tells us to ignore it. It often, especially women, we're often told it's not real. It's in your head. Go see a psychiatrist. It's terrible. It's maddening, right? But it's not. It is in your body. There is usually some issue going on, and it's a reflection of what's usually going on in your life. If it's to do with your heart, you know, like it's often to do with your path in your life. And if you're happy to be the journey that you're taking, are you happy with that or not? Does it feel like it's really in alignment with your soul?
I don't think think a lot of people know what a functional nutritionist does or what functional medicine is. And so could you describe that, please?
Functional medicine is really mostly specialty lab testing, right? So it's all those labs that some people might have not even heard about, but there are all these labs that are done outside of what, you know, you probably, and most people have only heard of like LabCorp and Quest, you know, those are the big labs that most doctors and hospitals work with, but there are all these tons of smaller specialty labs that do testing, some better than others. And it gives you really just a more comprehensive look at what's going on in the body. Like, for example, like, if you know, there's a lot of information about gut health now, right, and how important that is. So there's a lot more testing that can be done, because often, like, for example, parasitic infections and imbalances in the gut are not going to be caught on regular lab tests. They just aren't. I think I would say that 90% of parasitic infections are not caught on these regular lab tests. It's awful. So I usually send off to different places, and there's usually something that they catch. Now the flip side is sometimes it's too sensitive and it catches stuff that doesn't need to be treated. So that's, I've learned that from, you know, making my own mistakes, that sometimes that is, can be a little bit of an issue. We're finding stuff that, you know, we can just kind of let be dormant, or kind of ignore, because the body's immune system can clear it up by itself. So there's that unfortunate side to it. But I think it's good to, in general, it nets out positive when you find out. And it's also validating as a patient too, like, oh my God, I probably had this parasite for 20 years, or no wonder I've been feeling so sick. So, you know, a lot of these tests are great.
I think part of the challenge is just getting the insurance companies to actually pay for them, which they probably wouldn't, which is such a bummer. Just for my own edification, you know, they are talking so much, and I'm such a firm believer in the health of the gut, and the gut being, you know, the second brain of the body. Yes. And I do think, and I'm sure you're going to agree with me, can you believe I just said that? But I think the heart and the gut are like really talking to each other, that they have a really profound relationship. But I think the gut and the brain are also talking to each other, and the vagus nerve connects all of it. But like the health of your gut, it cannot be overstated enough that our guts are probably in terrible shape and that we need to do better by them.
Absolutely. I think the last research that I read about gut health, only a minority of people actually have healthy biome in the gut. I was actually shocked. It's less than half. It's like a minority. I think, you know, that I don't know if you remember, there was this place where they were getting samples of poop from a lot of people, and they were doing that research. You remember that? Anyway, so they basically realized that it was not a large percentage. They actually ended up rejecting the majority of people's poop because it was not considered healthy. There was bacterial overgrowth, abnormal bacterial overgrowth. They had parasites in them because they were testing the DNA so they could see all of that stuff. So unfortunately, the most of us are walking around, you know, with loose stools, constipation, abnormal flora in the gut. And going to your point about the connection with the heart and the gut. So in Chinese medicine, that's part of the fire system. The heart and the small intestine are actually grouped together. So yes, you are right. And also because the small intestine, the intestines have so much to do with serotonin release. So if your gut's funky, your serotonin's going to go down and your anxiety is going to go up, right? And so your heart's going to become overly active, not in a good way, in a negative way.
I have discovered that, you know, I used to have more anxiety. I have been doing a lot of work. You have to know this over the last few years.
Yes.
If that's not clear. And I have noticed, and I try to tell people that when I have a large feeling of anxiety, like I feel like I can't breathe and I have anxiety, I think to myself, oh my gosh, I need to cry. And I will go and I will just sob and sob. And it's this catharsis. And by the time I'm done, my anxiety's gone. My heart feels calm and I feel so much better. And I can be like that for months, but it is whenever it starts building and I feel it, I think to myself, okay, it feels like something needs to be released. I can tell.
Absolutely. So in your case, that would be your relationship between your lung and your heart. Yeah. So that's when your lungs get filled up with grief, right? Because that's what holds grief for us. And so when the lungs start squeezing the heart, because it's so gets kind of like full energetically, and then the heart feels like it doesn't, it's almost like it gets overwhelmed and it feels like it really can't, it's almost like it gets a little claustrophobic, you know, and it can't get out. And that's usually when you know, if you can cry and you can grieve, and that's definitely how the anxiety can be also released too.
I think one of the things that I really had to work on was to become less ashamed or have less fear around catharsis and crying and letting go, and understanding that process as a almost like a cleansing, like a releasing. And you know, the different, what tears are made up of, it's absolutely fascinating. You know, the tears that you cry in joy have a different chemical makeup than the tears you release when you're sad. Or if you're in a dust storm and your eyes start watering, those tears are completely different. And first of all, I just have to say, like, that whole area, the tears, the tear ducts, all the chemicals that are released, that is like a miracle in itself. I don't even understand how that's possible.
Oh, absolutely. I think that, you know, emotions, they get released usually with tears, right? And the facial expression, the muscles and everything around the eyes. I think that, it's just through the, you know, because the tears are actually can be, you know, from a Chinese medical perspective, they're often to do with the heart too. So it's a way that it can be expressed with, because the flip side is there's the anxiety side where it's considered, I don't like to call it negative, but you know, the side that we probably don't want to be feeling, but it also houses joy too. So that's a spectrum. Yeah. So it's considered it's a spectrum of the heart energy that can come out through the eyes like that.
I could talk to you for like 10 years, but I am mindful of our time. And so I wanted to ask, you know, the main question of the podcast is, I would love to hear a story or stories, it could be more than one, of something that has happened in your life or something that you've witnessed that you consider to be magical or miraculous or mysterious, something that you would like to share that kind of changed your life.
I think that, so I actually wrote about this in my first book, in my memoir, that so when my mother was passing away in Australia, and so Australia was in lockdown and it was barely allowing many people back. So how I actually ended up being actually goes to Japan was there must have been some kind of divine intervention or something. Like, I don't know how that even worked out, that I was actually able to even get onto a plane. And then was able to, because I'm from Western Australia. And so just to let you know that Australia was in lockdown in general. So you had to spend 2 weeks in hotel quarantine. It's like solitary confinement. And Western Australia was shutting and opening its borders that entire time. And while I was actually on the plane, they announced that Western Australia was closing its borders again. And I was in Singapore changing flights and thinking, oh my God, like, this is it. I'm not going to be able to go. And they somehow, we were the last plane that was able to go into Australia. But otherwise, if I had been on the plane 12 hours later, I would have ended up in a different state because they would have siphoned us off into a different state. So then when I landed in Australia, I was told that I was part of this group on Facebook, and they said that, look, even if you make it back to Australia, you probably won't be able to see your mother because nobody, there was, I think, 10,000 people on this Facebook group. And it was called, I think, Australian Stranded Overseas or something like that. And all these people were talking about trying to get back to Australia. I was one of the few people that actually got back to Australia. I don't know how. And all these people said to get an exception to get out of the hotel quarantine to see somebody dying, impossible. They said, don't even bother trying. They said, you can try if you want to, but nobody, not one story of anybody getting out. And I thought, I guess I'm going to try anyway, right? So I started emailing people the email address that I had. Nothing. And I was about to give up. And one of my friends randomly emailed me and said, oh, you shouldn't give up, because I was just talking to one of my friends, and you know, he actually went to see his mom. You keep trying. And I said, what email address? And he goes, I don't know, but you've got to keep trying. And then I thought, I'm just going to find every single email address that's associated with hotel quarantine. And I just email bombed 100 people. And finally somebody responded, and I was actually able to meet my mom. I think the only person that was actually, you know, able to get out in the entire group of, I don't know, how thousands of people, right? And so I was actually able to see my mom for 30 minutes, which is, you know, crazy that you only see somebody for 30 minutes. That's the last time I saw her. But the fact that I was actually even able to see her was absolutely miraculous. And the guy, the nurse who orchestrated that whole experience said, he was, you know, the head of the nursing department of hospice care, so he sees a lot of dying people. And he said, I was one of the handful of people who was able to actually get through and see the dying loved one still alive. By the time that they, you know, processed the whole thing, most people had already passed away. So extremely fortunate. And it all kind of had to fall into place exactly at the right time. And my mother ended up dying, I think maybe a day or so after that, after I saw her. And the doctor also, her palliative care doctor, just because I got there, she knew I was trying to get to see my mother. She gave her blood transfusion. They usually don't do this, just to keep her alive. So that was miraculous that she did that for me. Yeah. So there were so many different aspects of that I think that, you know, that was supposed, I felt like, oh, wow, I feel like some force is helping me to see my mom. I only actually really got to connect with her spirit for a few seconds at the very, very end, but I still got to do it. And that's what I remember about her, is connecting with that part. And I think it's a really, for me, amazing experience that's the last moment that I have with her.
I think, you know, only because I've read a lot of science magazines and they've had this subject and this topic, that I think a lot of people don't understand that people who are unconscious in the hospital or in a coma or what have you, many times they can hear you.
Yes.
When you're there. I mean, they might seem like they're completely out of it and in another place or unresponsive, but they will know when you're there, if you're talking to them or holding their hand, if you're present or whatever that looks like, there is a part of them that can hear you and understand what's going on.
Yes, I think from what I understand, and I don't know how they actually know this, but the hearing is the last thing to go when we die. And again, I don't know how they've discovered this, but anyway, that's what I've read. And so even though they might not be able to see you, they can still hear you. Even if they might not be conscious, they can still hear. That part is still awake.
And through their ears, their heart can connect with yours.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that, you know, it's a dual experience, right? It's for them just as much as it is for us.
I would like to just switch gears and ask you if you feel comfortable sharing one of the more, I don't know, interesting or magical, maybe healings that you've seen through Oriental medicine or your work, just the power of acupuncture, the power of Oriental medicine.
Okay, so this doesn't happen all the time, but it's magical when it happens. And so if somebody comes to see me, and I'll often say, oh, it's going to take some time, you know, so I'll take some sessions. I don't know how long, but I'll take some sessions. And they come back the next time, they're like, it's gone. I'm like, oh, well, I didn't realize that. I'm not that good. I don't know what happened. But that occasionally that happens. And that's incredible when that happens for them. And well, then for me too, I guess. But, placebo, there's a lot of things that play into that, right? But it's amazing. And it can be something you've had, chronic pain, anything. It can be so many different things. And they can be good for a very long time. Sometimes I don't hear from them for years. 10 sometimes, and then they're like, oh, you know, something else happened or something. But it is kind of magical when that happens.
And I think one of the things, you almost said it, but one of the things that I find most intriguing and absolutely fabulous is that there is this thing called the placebo effect. Yes. And I was interviewing a philosopher for my show a few months ago, and she said, I cannot even tell you how crazy it makes me that we have this thing called the placebo effect, where people get cured simply by, you know, I don't know, someone could say, oh, take this sugar pill. And this is Prozac, but they give them a sugar pill instead and the person gets better, or they have something else going on and they think they're getting the medication and their illness clears up. She said, all of Western medicine should be very scared that this effect exists, because it means that potentially we can cure ourselves. There's something in the body that can help us cure ourselves.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is when I used to teach, I said this to my students all the time, placebo is a real thing and you want to use it to your advantage. It's not going to, you can't rely on it, but it's the icing, and you want to learn how to speak to maximize placebo. There's this whole language that can go into that. And I think that it's very important to work with your patient's mind to give them that reassurance and to say, look, hey, this is something that I treat all the time. And, you know, most people get better. And just hearing from other patients, and this is really lovely when this happens, because, you know, at this point in my practice is mostly referral based, and they're only going to get referred. Nobody's going to come to me saying, somebody referred me that said that you were awful. You know, that's not going to happen. Most people will come because they're like, oh, you know, she cured me or whatever. And then, so they already have it in their mind, cured my friend, I'm going to get better too. So I've already got that going for me, which is great. Half the work done.
That's amazing. And I hadn't even considered that before, but that is absolutely fabulous. And I just love it. Well, for my listeners, what do you think is the one thing that we can do, you know, maybe daily, maybe every other day, maybe once a week, that would be good for our bodies and souls? You know, whether it's yoga or meditation or walking in nature, what is a form of self-care that we can do that will help our hearts and our bodies?
I think just to ask ourselves, like we talked about in the beginning, what do I want? What do I want? And if that voice is, oh, you're being selfish, you need to listen to it even more. It's really about indulging yourself in whatever it is. And it can be, you might feel like it's, oh my gosh, it's so frivolous, but I think it's really important. If it's something that you really want, I'm not saying that, you know, you should go buy a 20 carat diamond ring or anything like that. I'm thinking about something that you really want for yourself, like an activity or have an experience. Or if you've been working really hard to take that vacation that you've been putting off, you know, these things that are really going to fulfill you. And because often we get so busy living our lives and then for other people, and to stop and ask yourself, what's going to make me happy?
That's beautiful. And guess what? I feel like if you get quiet enough, our hearts can tell us.
Absolutely. It is. it is a skill. And some people are better at doing it than others. And also, if you have that negative voice of you should be doing this, or you're a bad person, or you're a selfish person, all that kind of, you've got to work through all of that before you, because your heart's quite shy, unless you're narcissistic, right? When, you know, most of us are not. But, you know, the small percentage of narcissistic people, they don't need to worry about this, because they're at the center of the universe and that's all they care about. So, but all the rest of us who are not narcissistic, then yes, listen to the heart, its desires, listen to it every single day, because then it will start to speak a little bit more and a little bit, and it will come much clearer. But at first, it's often we've ignored it for such a long time. It's barely a whisper and it's so shy that it's in the corner, and it's like, hi, me. You forgot about me 25 years ago.
Yeah, I experience my heart now a little bit like a nag, because that's where our relationship is at this point, but it's like a good nag. So it's getting me on the right path and to walk the straight and narrow. You know, if it's not speaking to me when I'm awake, it comes to me in my dreams. Uh-huh. And it just is like, it's not that it won't leave me alone, but it's like unequivocal in like what I need to change. And it's sometimes not super complimentary either in my dreams. And I'm like, oh, someone's got something to say. So I think it's also good to know that your heart will communicate with you and try to get through to you whichever way it can.
Absolutely. And it is complicated, because, you know, we're not just a heart, right? We have an ego. There's so many different conflicting motivations that we have. And it's not to say that the ego isn't important, because I do think all of it's important. What we want intellectually, socially speaking, from other people, what our heart wants, they can sometimes conflict, and we have to sit with all these different parts, almost like in a conference room, and you've got your heart here and you've got your mind here and you've got all these other, you know, people that you have to consider, and you have to be at a round table together and be like, okay, all right, you get this today, your brain, you get that part, tomorrow you have to wait a little bit. And, you know, does that make sense? Like, it's hard to listen to. It's I think, I guess, unrealistic to give your heart 100% what it wants all the time.
Even if it's a gallon of ice cream, not a good idea.
No, exactly. So, you know, these are things that, you know, you want to have all those different parts, because sometimes it might not necessarily be good for you too. So you want to be able to discern that what your desires are and what necessarily is healthy for you might not necessarily be on the same page, which is tricky. And that's a higher level. That's like a master's level of figuring out what your heart needs.
This very next episode of the podcast and my super groovy interview with Momoko Uno. I'm grateful to her for her patience with me around all of my questions and for entertaining even the idea of being on this podcast. I'm grateful she accepted my invite, because the conversation for me was priceless. Thanks to all of you who listen to this podcast, and thanks to all of you who have written a review or left a rating. Those ratings and reviews help other people find us, and so I do hope that if you find it within your heart to do so, please consider writing a review or leaving a little rating. You'll never know how much it makes my heart happy to see those ratings and reviews. As well, everyone, if you'd like to discover a little bit more about my guest this week, Momoko, there will be a link in the episode show notes to the wellness center where she works, Omni Wellness, in New York's Flatiron District. There you can find out a little bit more about the work they do there, as well as a little bit more about Momoko. And thank you to everyone who's subscribed to my YouTube channel. There will be a link in the episode show notes for you to click on it, check it out a little bit. And if you feel so inclined to subscribe, there you'll get to see my guests' shiny faces as they tell their stories of bite-sized miracles. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Momoko. Be enchanted with learning. Be curious about the world. I know on this podcast I'm always saying, I'm so curious. I'm endlessly curious, and I do think that curiosity is a superpower. And I have no doubt that Momoko and all her education and all of her learning, that she has an inborn sense of curiosity. She's in love with the world and she wants to know more about it. She wants to become a bigger player in it, to heal people, to help people. So be like Momoko and nurture an endless well of curiosity inside yourself. And so very soon, I absolutely suspect you'll fall deeper in love with the world.